Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to day two of the ships of Tarshish. I'd like to commence by reading you some words from Charles Dickens that have been rephrased by me. And as a lead into our subject today, old Tarshish was as dead as a doornail. That must be thoroughly understood if anything wonderful can come from the events I'm about to relate. The registry of its burial was foreseen and foreordained 10,000 years before the oceans rolled, but made known to us in recent times by the prophets of God. And the Almighty's mark on the affairs of man is unfailingly accurate to whatever situation he proposes. Yesterday, at the very end of the lecture, we saw the very seminal event in the destruction of the city of Tyre. As you recall, Tyre and Tarshish were soulmates. They were together in this huge trading venture, and they were the heart and soul of the world as far as bringing the goods, the exotic goods, the unusual, the amazing, the brilliant, the beautiful, from all over the corners of the earth to that one central city from whence people would come and buy. Without that city, Tarshish was in a very difficult position. And slowly, after Tyre's destruction, everything, all her assets, began to float away, in effect. They were taken over by Carthage in North Africa. And as we saw before, with the commencement of that time, the fog that originally surrounded the island in terms of mystery now enshrouded it again. The riddle became lost, and so was the nation, or the people of Tarshish. Today, my main purpose is to reveal those emergent events necessary to stir life back into that moldering corpse, now having lain dormant for nearly 1,800 years in the dust of England. Like so many things, it came as the words of the Apostle Paul revealed to the church of Corinth. Matthew. 1 Corinthians 1, 22 and 27. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom, that is human wisdom, knew not God. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. With the end of the English Civil War, the Battle of the Roses, Henry VII emerged as victor. Henry VII would always be scarred by the events that he had gone through, and he was very, very aware of what that nation needed in the short run and in the long run. Mostly, he wanted to make sure that there would be an heir to carry on after he was gone. He knew that how fragile that nation was, it could very easily fall back again into civil disobedience. So, he preened his oldest son, Arthur, for the job of being the next king. Unfortunately, Arthur suddenly died. He died, and with it, new events took place that would change the course of English history. And that event started with one man, the foolish thing I'm talking about that Paul describes. That one man who was destined originally to be either a scribe or a church clergyman was Henry Jr. And later, in 1513, when his father passed, he would become Henry VIII. Now, before his father died, he saw fit to try to arrange a marriage for Henry. Remember, in those days, love meant very little when you're talking about a crown. Love meant very little at all. People arrange marriages, sometimes from when children were very young. And Henry was suddenly in need of a wife because, as I said, they needed an heir. And so here was one already available. Catherine of Aragon had married Arthur and was destined to be the queen. And now she was without a job. But Henry VII wanted Catherine because of the close ties with Spain and the Holy Roman Empire. There was wonderful opportunities in terms of trade, and that's what Henry VII was thinking about. Whether Henry VIII would want that, it's hard to say. But nonetheless, that's what was arranged. And Henry went along with it, and he married Catherine of Aragon, a princess of Spain. Well, Catherine tried her very best to be a dutiful wife. She was certainly kind. She was certainly loving. She was certainly very caring. She lacked wit and that spontaneity that kings often enjoy. But she had these other attributes. The one thing that she wasn't able to do was to produce an heir for Henry VIII. 5 times she had tried within the 5 years, and each time she miscarried. And each time Henry's heart sank. At first, it was a source of great sorrow. However, with ever-increasing occurrence, it had become a major aggravation. Gradually, the black cloud Henry felt at the funeral of each of his children soon developed into an invisible wall between both king and queen. More and more, Henry was away fighting in France, or just plain hunting. Then, to Henry's great surprise, the queen was found again to be with child, and once more, hope sprang eternal. With this baby, Catherine had gone full term, a surprise even to Henry. After 9 months, he was summoned back to his castle from a hunting expedition. He arrived to a situation of both laughter and gaiety. Was it possible? Did he finally have his coveted heir? Oh, how his heart leapt in his chest when toasts were made to both king and queen. Then the queen's nurse stood forth on the balcony with baby in one hand and with great aplomb announced, "Your Majesty, you are the proud father of a beautiful baby girl," at which at that time everyone erupted into clapping and into praise. And Henry, too, was caught up in the moment. And then suddenly it hit him. Like a ton of bricks it hit him. Did she say girl? A girl? No. Cat? Yes, a girl! You mean to tell me that I've been waiting for 6 long years and Catherine up and delivers a girl? Well, fine. Just fine. And with that, his countenance fell. And Henry stormed out. He stormed out not just for that night, but for all intents and purposes for good. It was still doubtful, even under English law, if a woman could succeed the throne. And would England even tolerate it, being ruled by a woman? Might the new child turn out to be bigoted and narrow-minded like Catherine? How would the people take to having a woman as their queen? With too many questions for Henry, he turned away from the idea entirely. In time, Catherine named the child Mary, after the Virgin Mother. But her father's aloofness and distance would have long-range effects for both Catherine and her daughter. After a few years, Henry decided to send her away, to send her from the court and into the country. And that just about killed Catherine. Catherine was so terribly crushed by that experience. Now, Henry realized that there would be no children. In 1527, Henry decided to appeal to the church for a divorce against his wife and queen. And he did it under the flimsiest of grounds. Now, Henry understood that a divorce accommodations could be made with the church if the price was right. Twice recently, it had been done in the circle of his own family. But that was then, and this was now. The times had changed. In 1527 AD, Rome was sacked by orders of Charles V, the present emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and King of Spain. Some 40,000 wild-eyed Germans attacked Rome, and Pope Clement VII was now a prisoner in an Italian castle. With his imprisonment, a completely different atmosphere existed in Rome than previously. More important than even that, brothers and sisters, Charles V happened to be Catherine of Aragon's favorite nephew. And you know the saying, blood is thicker than water. With Spanish and German troops holding the Pope prisoner, Henry VIII knew that a papal dispensation for divorce was out of the question. To add fuel to the fire, not only did Henry desire to dispense with his wife, but what did he do? He up and went and married a Protestant from France. The woman was named Anne Boleyn. This sudden desire of Henry was a bombshell to the people of England, still steeped in both superstition and Catholicism. You see, a king may control the people's lives in his realm. He may, to some extent, control their purse, but the church controlled their minds. And of the two, the latter was far and away more powerful when mortality had come into play. Remember, in that time, the average age of most people was normally 35 years when they died. That's not very old, today's standards. And so, people always had before them the idea of death and the need to prepare for it. As far as most of Henry's subjects were concerned, divorce to Catherine and marriage to a Protestant put them in real grave danger of war, and perhaps worse, a papal interdict. Now, if you're not aware what a papal interdict is, let me explain. If the Pope placed an interdict on your nation, what it meant was that all the church buildings would be barred and chained from attendees. To the common man who had little in this world, a failure to provide absolution for those sick to survive, or the loss of baptismal rites for your children would, in the event of death, condemn both classes to eternal hell fire. Dispute this as we may today, in the 1500s, this doctrine was both taught and it was believed. And yet, despite the grim possibilities facing England, Henry VIII still remained optimistic. With the papacy in prison and France in a state of war, he had time to still make plans of his own. Unwilling to just sit and wait for the axe to fall, he upstaged Pope Clement VII by calling Parliament into session for 7 continuous years. And that was unusual. Only time you called Parliament in was when you wanted to get tax money. And once you got that, the king normally dismissed them. But in this case, he had a much bigger thing at stake. At the end of that time, the following new statutes and laws came into being. The first was the supplication against the ordinaries. The second was the annate bill. And the third was the act of supremacy. What these laws boiled down to was the following fact. Catholicism now became Protestantism, and the King of England, not some Roman prelate, was now the new head of the church with its many, many assets. In the country, villages, and towns, most Englishmen at first were stymied by Henry's decision. At court, Henry was already feeling a simmering undercurrent from his nobles. And in the north, open rebellion, where a vast Catholic majority existed. Somehow, some way, he had to get the people behind him. But how? What it came up with was a complete reversal of all previous policies by the English monarchs. Anybody know what that was? What he came up was a complete reversal of all policies by English monarchs. What I'm talking about is the printing off in Paris of the English Bible, 1538. The English Bible was printed off and then it was brought into the country. And this time it wasn't burnt as it had been in the past. This time, Henry VIII took those Bibles and he placed them into his Anglican churches, his new Anglican churches. Anywhere there was an alcove, a small vestibule, an outcrop, wherever space could be found, three things came into being. First, a rostrum, similar to this. Second, a candle. And third, the new Bible. And that Bible, brothers and sisters, was chained there so it couldn't be removed. Now, in Henry's mind, it would allow a few interested people to hear the scriptures read. And then, only if you had a reader. Remember, most people in those times couldn't read at all. However, what actually occurred was far different. On weekdays and on Sunday, people arrived but rarely went into the great hall. Despite the unheated conditions, the cold walls, and the little space from those forlorn rostrums became a focal point for people to sit and in many cases hear for the first time a complete reading of the scriptures. In some cases, a complete reading of an entire chapter. Here for the first time, the Bible began to electrify people as they sat there quiet and spellbound. They listened with their hearts as much as with their minds. On the other hand, woe betide any reader who made the mistake of attempting to interpret what was written. Interpretation still was under the domain of the church, and they guarded it jealously with prison sentences. And in those days, by the way, brothers and sisters, if you got sent to prison, they didn't feed you. You better have family to bring food in because you starved to death. And even if they brought food in, the guards had the first crack at it. So you can see how terrible those conditions would be. And there were many a person who made this mistake and died for it. However, outside of the church was a completely different matter. There the spoken word was openly and sometimes hotly contested. There the good news spread from mouth to mouth. And there was power in God's word. And it manifested itself in many remote places where secrecy and quiet could be obtained. Despite the common man's inability to possess their own Bible, the genie was out of the bottle. Ironically, William Tyndale's seemingly forgotten words now came back to haunt the very authorities who in the first place opposed him and had burned his life's work. I like to quote to you his words. "It is my hope," he said, "that the man behind the plow will know more about the Word of God than the preacher behind the pulpit. Looking back upon these events, Thomas Huxley reported, he said, I quote, "Consider the great historical fact that this book has been woven into the life of all that is noblest in English history, that it has become a national epic of Great Britain." Barbara Tuchman, a Jewish historian and author of the book The Bible and the Sword, made this insightful observation. I quote, "A single God and a chosen people who are the transmitters of his message was how a generation of English came to know the book. Everyone knew it. It was read over and over until its words and images and characters and story became as familiar as bread. Children learned chapters by heart and usually knew the geography of Palestine long before they knew their own. For Englishmen, this black print on a white page became their tower of strength, their measure of resolve. Soon a sense of ownership resulted. We have God on our side," said many a sailor. As time went on, the reading of the Word helped to demystify the book and made it both impacting and real in the present. Now, with the break with the Catholic Church, it was inevitable that new laws came into effect. For one, Catholic monastic lands, monasteries, now became the property of the crown. Up till this time, brothers and sisters, one-third of present-day England was owned by the Catholic Church. England wasn't a country. It was a patchwork quilt. Roads began but ended at Catholic property. More importantly, Catholic lands were not subject to taxation, leasing, or even outright sale. However, with one stroke of the pen, that all changed. The Act of Supremacy. Henry VIII, not the Pope, was now the country's supreme landlord. For thousands and thousands of sharecroppers under his control, that was going to have very serious consequences in the days to follow. You have to remember, feudalism was only just beginning to throw off its shackles, and these lands were how most people made a living as far back as anyone could remember. In the beginning, the church parceled out to a man land, and he worked it. When his children got old enough, he divided his parcel between his sons, and they in turn did the same. However, over hundreds and hundreds of years, family parcels diminished in size so much that people were unable to make a living. Fortunately, the monks and friars of the Catholic Church understood this. You see, number one with the Catholic Church was loyalty. Before one balanced the books. Yes, tenants were poor, no doubt, but they at least remained Catholic, and that was a source of power. However, all that changed once the Act of Supremacy came into existence. Suddenly, England was united to all her lands. Former church property could now be outright sold or leased, and with either option, the land would remain taxable, providing the crown with more annual income. And that's where the problem for thousands of people came into being. And this is a significant point, brothers and sisters, when you think of Tarsus of old. What was famous about Tarsus was she set up colonies, was it not? And it was from those colonies that she traded, received raw materials, and to some degree sold finished products, right? And so, with the removal of the Catholic Church, suddenly all these people were no longer needed. This is where the problem came in. It was like the California gold rush. Numerous merchants and lords rushed to purchase or lease these new lands. In some cases, they paid a pretty hefty price. Because of that fact, those entrepreneurs were not about to continue the Catholic practice of hearts and flowers with their tenants. Philanthropy be damned. They were there to get immediate returns on their investment. And I don't mean going to the local grocers, hat in hand, selling corn, cabbage, and cucumbers. Instead, the new landlords wanted to replace the tens of thousands of postage stamp farmers with a man, his wife, and a good dog. In short, they wanted to turn those fields back into pasture for raising what? Sheep. They wanted to raise sheep. It was wool, not vegetables, that made money on the open market. In fact, in those days, they had very little ability to even store those things in order to sell them across to their neighbors in Europe. And England's wet climate and grasslands made a wonderful coat for English shepherds to harness. So, without warning or mercy, tens of thousands of previous farmers were given their eviction notices and sent packing. And it was a terrible, terrible shame. Many of these people had old women and very young children. Nevertheless, they were sent out on the roads to find whatever they could and make a living. Eventually, many of these poor, displaced souls ended up in the very place least prepared to accept them, the urban cities. In summary, this mass movement of people started during the reign of Henry VIII, but it would carry on for hundreds of years. It would spread from monastic lands to private lands, and even into the green areas surrounding villages and towns. Historians refer to this change by one word, a dirty word, according to the local people. They called it enclosure. But to the commoner, it meant the loss of their livelihoods, the loss, in some cases, of their families, and the forceful relocation into new places that they had never been before. Mines, into the middle of the cities to try to eke out a living, into factories. All of these things completely altered their lifestyle. It was this corollary that the 19th century writer Charles Dickens wrote books like David Copperfield and Great Expectations. Over time, many of the displaced would end up, as I said, in these sweatshops. However, the less able often resorted to crime or begging. As an answer to the growing unrest, the Crown offered in return was workhouses, orphanages, the treadmill, prison ships, and exile to faraway places to work off their debt and passageway. These indentured servants, as they were called, in time came to places like Canada, the Americas, South Africa, and even Australia. This mass migration of criminals and adventurers alike is what created colonies, secured a ready market for the British-made goods, and returned to the mother country a steady supply of precious raw materials. Later, Napoleon Bonaparte would refer to this strange English paradox by calling their people a nation of shopkeepers. How prophetic. Yes, it was a sad day for many when enclosure came to England. However, if, brothers and sisters, there was a silver lining to this terrible thing, it came in this form. It forced the people to come out of themselves. It stopped their dependence on the church and anything else for that matter. And it began the process of looking outward progressively for success and self-sufficiency. This same spirit was what drove the ancient Tarsus. It may have come to Britain differently than it did with her ancient mariner past, but it came notwithstanding. Once again, this island's geography was dictating a way to the future. See. Isaiah says, somewhat cryptically, the people of the sea coast, the merchants of Sidon, wail. People whose agents cross the great waters, whose harvest is the grain of Shihor, and their revenue the trade of nations. Is this your busy city, ancient in story, on whose voyages you were carried to settle far away? So we began to see that. And also, I'd like to turn your attention to Isaiah 23, verse 18. I want to read this to you right from the Scriptures. It's talking, the entire chapter, in one of the few places, talks about Tyre and Tarshish. And it says, "And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing." Now, brothers and sisters, that's a future reference. That hasn't even happened yet. But the only way it could happen is if somehow old Tarshish became reinvigorated and restarted. And what I'm trying to tell you today are the emergent events that made that possibility a reality. Before we leave the religious laws and their effects, there is one very important event to arise worthy of consideration from Henry's dealings with the Church of Rome. With the sudden influx of new revenues into the crown's coffers because of all this new land that they took over, the king decided to address the need for an English navy. It was a first. Unlike any English kings before him, Henry VIII understood the importance of sea power. He recognized that a nation that could not protect its merchant fleet at sea or from an invasion at home could not call itself a world power. Looking forward, this effort to build a navy was what in time would enhance England's reputation and her claim to world fame. It was only a start, but how so very much in the cast and die of her ancient mariner past. As for the major Catholic nations lined up against him, Henry was most fortunate, as problems within and without delayed any immediate action on his domain. Anne Boleyn, however, was not so lucky. Like Catherine before her, she soon fell out of favor with the king. Despite Anne's beauty, despite her love for education, and despite her quick wit, Anne never stopped plotting against Catherine and Mary. The saying, "There is no wrath like that of a woman's," obviously had her in mind when it was written, and her many rants and rages only accelerated her demise. She did, however, to manage to give Henry an heir, albeit another female, Elizabeth. This little child may have started her life with the odds stacked against her. She may have been tiny and somewhat frail, but nothing, and I mean nothing, prepared the world for the dynamo she so soon would become. As for her mother Anne, her constant conniving led to charges of infidelity. For this, she was tried and found guilty. Her head soon would embellish one of the many fence spikes on the infamous slave gate beneath the Tower of London. Now, before leaving Henry VIII with his many dalliances and debauched behavior, we must remember Jane Seymour. Jane was a quiet spirit thrown into a tempest. Important to our subject was the fact that she accomplished what neither Catherine nor Anne nor any of the other wives of Henry could do. She alone gave Henry a son. He would eventually become Henry VI. For Henry, he was never happier than when in the company of this unpretentious lady. Unfortunately, she was always a flower that a cold breath of wind would wither. She died giving life to her baby boy. In the end, her death shook Henry to his foundation. He would live on, and he would even marry again, but never, ever would he recover from losing Jane. On a cold January day in 1547, Henry's tumultuous life ended. He died with the belief that his realm was safe under the control of a young but very mature Edward VI, and he was laid to rest beside his wife Jane. Unfortunately, what Henry did not know was that the mother's dark shadow had fallen across Edward's bassinet, and 16 years later, he would follow her to the grave. During Edward's brief 6-year reign, he did accelerate the process of converting former Catholic country to Protestant beliefs. He also gave charters out to men like Sebastian Cabot to search out and discover a passage to China through both Canada's northwest and Russia's northeast. Well, not much of either came of the adventures, but it did broaden England's horizon for trade, and at last, because she was very slow, started her on a quest for discovery of new lands and routes to the riches of the Far East. However, Edward's death created no small problem. With no more male heir, the crown was somewhat up for grabs. Knowing ahead of time he had a terminal disease, Edward attempted to have Lady Jane Grey, his cousin, replace him. In the Catholic North, however, they were going to have none of that. Raising a small army, they decided to champion the cause of their Catholic princess, the forlorn Mary. Assailing London with their forces, their timing could not be better. Without an army to protect her, aside from a few beefeaters, Lady Jane was dethroned and jailed after only 9 days of being queen. Suddenly, the little girl no one wanted around was elevated to the throne of England. Now, this is not a class on the kings and queens of England per se. So why talk about Mary at all? What possibly does she bring to our study of the ships of Tarshish that is helpful to appreciating the role of this emerging power? Well, you may recall Jezebel in the Old Testament. She was wife of King Ahab, and she was the daughter of the king of the Sidonians. Beside her role as queen, she saw her main duty in life as spreading the Sidonian worship of the false weather god Baal. And if you will recall, she did so with a vengeance, often murdering many of Israel's priests. Similarly, Mary ascended the throne, seeing her main role in life as reestablishing Catholicism. Mary had all the stubbornness of the Tudors, but none of their common sense. Growing up with rejection, watching her mother's health fail when forced from court, and kept from worshiping her own country faith in the new Anglican England, Mary had little confidence, and her somewhat gentle demeanor was trampled on by her new Catholic advisors. Eventually, her name would become synonymous with terror, and they called her Bloody Mary. If there were questions before about Catholicism, they were answered when apostasy's steely hand was unsheathed on a free society. With her arrival on the throne came the over-the-channel invitation to those sinister black frock priests, the Jesuits. Now, these people were anti-Reformationists, and they came with a plan. The first notable change was the removal of many chained Bibles from England's Anglican churches, and it was soon followed by the destruction of Edward VI's hymnals and prayer books. Secondly, the Puritan, Baptists, and the leaders of the Anglican Church, and any others who were leaders, soon became targets of Jesuit cleansing. Once the bonfires were ignited to burn the Bibles and books, it was only a hop, skip, and a jump before people would follow. Soon, the infamous published list was read in market streets by town criers, starting the dreaded witch hunt. Like the Jews of Nazi Germany, the worst offenders were rounded up and sent forthwith to the Tower for interrogation. a euphemism for torture. There were no official trials, but many were convicted nonetheless. The favorite way the Jesuits dealt with Protestant leaders was to introduce them to the bundles of dry faggots, that's dry wood. Tied at their feet, they would ignite them and slowly burn them at the stake. Lesser crimes were tried by local magistrates, but torture was often the method chosen for all that were interrogated. Now, I want you to think of this. This was an exact happening that did occur. Two of their bishops of the Anglican Church, Latimer and Ridley, were both tied up to a pole and had these faggots tied about their feet. They were ignited. Bishop Ridley began to be very upset and nervous. When Bishop Latimer saw that, he yelled over to his friend and said, "Ridley, hold fast and play the man. Today we are going to light such a light in England that it will never be extinguished." Thirdly, to ensure the reestablishment of a Catholic throne in England, Mary married the young Philip of Spain. Her hope was to procreate an heir for her throne. She was advised against this by her bishop all the way down to her lords because of the backlash they knew would follow. However, this was one time that Mary stood up to them. Mary and Philip were very much similar to Henry and Catherine. Mary was 36 when she began her reign, and Philip was barely out of his teens. As resistance to her reign grew stronger and stronger, young Philip deserted her for other business in Europe, much the way Henry did for Honey. This union, the arrival of the Jesuits, and the return of Catholicism eventually drove the area west of London, Devon to Cornwall, into open rebellion. To isolate this area for punishment was dangerous. This was where England's famous sailors hailed from. It was known then as the Wyatt Rebellion, and the fierceness of it lent no peace to an already troubled queen. The leaders, Edward Courtney, Earl of Devon, and Thomas Wyatt, regrettably were not good military leaders, and poor timing and an undisciplined army failed to stop the Catholic advance. With that failure, all the fury of the Inquisition was unleashed on the people of the West Country. According to Fox's Book of Martyrs, over 300 people were burned at the stake at the time of Mary's 5-year reign. But this was only a drop in the bucket to the thousands that were tortured. Notwithstanding, all Catholic attempts to stifle the Word of God proved impossible to carry out as enforcing prohibition in the 1930s. When fighting and rebellion failed to achieve, the Protestant fear accomplished. On one occasion, a dead dog with a halter on his throat and ears cropped was flung through the Queen's chamber with a message on it: "You and all your priests should be hanged." Following that occurrence, the Queen saw terrorists round every corner of the castle. Afraid to close her eyes, Queen Mary's health soon began to fail. In 1558, she announced she was with child, though her ladies-in-waiting were somewhat doubtful. Age was against her. 5 years older, at 42, the stress and fear belied the evidence growing within her abdomen. What she called a miracle was, in effect, aggressive cancerous tumor. On the 17th of November, 1558, Mary breathed her last, and all England sighed by reason of their afflictions. In her place, Mary's sister Elizabeth was anointed queen at the young age of 25, inheriting a small kingdom rife with strife. Many hoped that the circumstances would soon do her in, and they were numerous. There was hostility with France and Scotland. In Europe's eyes, the higher claim to legitimacy of Mary's Queen of Scotland was held over her present reign. England's pound had grown so weak that the government was compelled to devalue their money and pay 14% interest on any loans they made. There was no standing army and no money in the treasury to support one. Spain, an ally of Mary Tudor, now turned bitterly hostile to England due to their return to Protestant. And a personal vendetta of Philip II himself. Now he was king of Spain, and he wanted to get vengeance on the lady that had taken the place of his wife. As one former council clerk under Edward VI surveyed, the queen poor, the realm exhausted, the nobility poor and decayed, want of good captains and soldiers, the people out of order, justice not executed, all things dear, steadfast enmity, but no steadfast friendship abroad. And yet, despite all of these problems, Elizabeth managed to convey the appearance of calm, patience, and a positive outlook. Quick with wit and sharp of tongue, young Queen Bess quickly learned who to trust and who to suspect. To aid this paragon of the new learning was Elizabeth's ability to speak fluently five languages. In regards to religion, she, unlike her half-sister Mary, never punished a person for their affiliations or their beliefs, though her lords often insisted that she should. Instead, she would say to them, "My lords, what my people think is between them and God. Only their actions will I judge. Remember, my lords, fear only begets more of the same. Besides," she would add, "I'm convinced that my people truly love their queen." And to that end, she did her very best to court their affection. As historian Garrett Mattingly expressed, I quote, "To Englishmen who never saw Her Majesty except over the shoulders of a crowd as she passed along a highway, she was still Gloriana, the fairy queen, who cast over her island and over them all a golden spell. She was the living palladium of England. Her mystically guarded virginity was not only their pledge of independence from foreign prisons, it made her somehow belong to them all. Nor to Elizabeth either can it all been a game. She had never had a husband. She would never have a child. How much one wonders did the passion she gave to her people and the adoration they paid her with make up for what she had missed. She told them, no worldly thing under the sun was dearer to her as their love. Though you have had and may have many mightier and wiser princesses, you never have or had a queen that loves you more." With that kind of passion, she began to romance with the only suitor she ever took serious, her people. And this alone would still many a troubled waters at home. But not all. Many things were going wrong, and yet somehow she was able to survive. On one occasion, a half-crazed youth with pistol in his hand, standing only about 100 feet from her, fired, but the gun did not ignite. Shortly thereafter, Francis Remarkton, with papers in hand, revealed a widespread plot for Catholic uprising, which would start in Scotland, but end with Elizabeth's assassination. There was also William Parry's cold-blooded revelation that for murdering of Elizabeth I, he would receive a plenary absolution from the Pope. The most serious internal threat proved to be more from a relative and the next in line for the throne, Mary, Queen of Scots, now Elizabeth's prisoner in Fotheringay prison. The Queen of Scots, with the skillful aid of Anthony Babington, had plotted to have Elizabeth assassinated. In 1587, she died for her efforts, but she strengthened Spain's decision to take Elizabeth I down. Yes, the threats were real, they were cold, they were relentless. to counter all of these activities at the time, Elizabeth had enough common sense to place exceptional people in positions of power. Men that had character and a high standard, men like Bacon and Cecil and Walsingham. At sea, similar men of courage and genius were placed in positions of authority. The first man of importance to speak of is Francis Drake. Son of a Devonshire hedge parson, he learned his Puritan faith from his father. Aiding him in his endeavor was his cousin, the young John Hawkins, the second man of notoriety. Both were adventurers at sea, and as time went on, they both became leaders in their own right and captains of renown. Now, time will not permit me to tell you of all the adventures of a man like Francis Drake. He was amazing. One time he attacked Cadiz, and he blew away their ships, their warehouses, their storehouses, and even their shipbuilding capacity. On another occasion, he moved off to the Cape Saint Verde, and there he encountered thousands and thousands of tons of salted fish. He destroyed those fish stocks and later burned the wooden staves that he found there. Little did he know that in the future those wooden staves would be put into making barrels, and those barrels would be what was to hold Spain's freshwater meat and water. And without those staves, they would have to use green wood, and green wood promoted decay, and green wood leaked. So all of these things were going to come into play in the future. When he returned to England after his famous voyage to Cadiz, he was knighted by the crown. But he brought a message with him. He said, "I have bought you some time, Your Majesty, but prepare ye well." Prepare ye well. That later requirement fell upon the second seaman of importance, John Hawkins. His new responsibility was entitled the Treasurer of the Queen's Majesty Marine Cause. This rather lengthy title simply meant that he was responsible for repairing, building, and maintenance of the Queen's naval fleet. Now, his father-in-law had performed that job before him, but he gave it up gladly, exhorting his son-in-law, "I take this thorn out of my foot, and I put it in yours." Too soon, John Hawkins was to discover the truth of those words. His new responsibilities required long, lonely hours, labor disputes, and arguments on how to employ the existing resources, which were always in short order. Now please look at the overhead of an English galley. English galley. What you observe above is what is reviewed every day he came to work. To refit and rebuild them at cost efficient as possible created a huge conundrum. It seemed a case of too little, too late. In contrast, silver and gold flowed into Spain in quantities that would rival the stars in heaven. Over and over he asked himself, "What can I do with the small resources I have to prepare England for the battle to come?" Well, the answer lies in an old prophecy given by Moses in Deuteronomy 29, verse 29. He said, "The secret things belong unto God, but the things which are revealed belong unto us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." The secret things are the hidden things, brothers, sisters, and friends. They remain secret until God in His wisdom allows men to understand them. Like Gutenberg's printing press, they are more likely to be discovered in times of crisis than at any other time. If ever there was such a moment, this was it. Somewhere on one of his many walks at Deptford and Chatham, he began to meditate, and suddenly he received an epiphany. What he discovered was that if he took down these high towers at front here and in the back, this tower in the fore and this tower in the aft, if he took those down, he would have the better ability for a ship to maneuver. You notice this tall mast in the back here? If he took that down, he could extend up on the top quarters more headsails and topsails, and it would give him a better ability to run with the wind. Also, it would allow him to cover over this area here and make an upper and a lower deck. And by cutting down the front of the ship, again, he would help himself out greatly in the ship's ability to maneuver. He did these things, and he placed in here, just as he hid over here, cannons. Yes, cannons was going to be the new way in which England was going to fight Spain at sea. The only way. They couldn't take them on, as this shows, by fighting them from sea, from ship to ship. That was the common way that people fought in those days. They would simply grapple on, come over, and they would fight using their old methods of swords and spears. But he knew that it would be impossible to do that. The rival he was up against was immense. They had the finest army in Europe. They, the Spanish, created one of the greatest scenes in the history of man. It was a horrible scene. 800 conquistadors killed 100,000 Aztec Indians. And they did it with swords and spears. And then they raped their women and stole their gold, even imprisoning their children to work for them. Well, I've gone over my time, and we'll pick up there tomorrow. Thank you.